It's the Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. In the first several weeks of the pandemic, residents were told to shelter at home, work from home if at all possible. Now people are selling and buying homes. Howard Hanna Mortgage Services wrote a record number of new mortgages in June, while Realtor.com says home prices in Pittsburgh are now higher than in January of this year. This surge in the market comes as the Mortgage Bankers Association is reporting a decrease in mortgage credit availability based on Ellie Mae data. Joel Kahn is Associate Vice President of Economic and Industry Forecasting at the Association. Joel, first off, your reporting indicates that lending standards are tightening as demand for mortgages is rising. So who is getting financed right now, and maybe who isn't making the cut?
Right now, we're seeing credit really sort of available for, what you would call sort of your standard borrower who has a solid employment situation. They have pretty high credit scores, and they have all their documentation in place. For those who might be having a little bit of trouble getting a mortgage, these are typically lower credit scores with higher loan-to-value ratios. And you also have the jumbo market and the non-qualified mortgage parts seeing a lot of tightening as well.
Remind us, what exactly is a jumbo loan? Who's likely to apply for those?
Right. So a jumbo loan is basically a loan with a higher loan amount than Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac are willing to purchase. So for most areas, that's about $510,000. And for some of what they define as the high-cost areas with higher home prices, that's about $765,000. So anything above those amounts, that's what's considered a jumbo loan. Typically, the kinds of borrowers that we see in those are either getting a more expensive house or a bigger house, but also these do tend to be individuals or even co-borrowers with higher incomes and much higher credit scores. And again, just a very complete application.
You have mentioned a couple of times now solid credit scores, higher credit scores. Are larger down payments needed now as well?
We haven't really seen a big change. I think most lenders are still looking at 20% down as the standard.
Mm-hmm. What about buyers who want to purchase a fixer-upper in a so-called up-and-coming neighborhood? How is financing now? Is it getting tighter for that sort of sale as well?
I think it really comes down to the borrower's qualifications for the loan. Most neighborhoods and most parts of the country are actually seeing still pretty solid home price growth. There are requirements that lenders do look for in a property. That's where the appraisal comes in. But again, it's more what the borrower can afford.
With the number of COVID cases surging here in the Pittsburgh area and in many states, how are lenders looking ahead and betting on which borrowers, whether they're for residential properties or in industries, that they'll be able to pay their mortgages 6 months from now, whether they're, you know, gainfully employed or they're doing business and doing it well?
So it's actually a tough time for everyone right now. The economic outlook is still filled with uncertainty. And yes, while there are some industries or some job sectors that have been hit particularly hard, it's still hard for lenders, for anyone really, to predict what's going to happen 6 months from now. I think when it comes to the underwriting process, lenders are seeking a little bit more transparency from the borrower as far as what they might expect in the near future, but they can only sort of underwrite to what they have in front of them. So again, you know, your typical credit score requirements, documentation, and then maybe a little bit of extra verification from the borrower's employer, you know, verification of their income closer to the closing date. But again, that's as good as we can do right now.
Many banks across the country are shuttering branches, pushing online banking to their customers. At the same time, interest rates are at record lows. Banks aren't making all that much money on loans. Are banks under pressure at all to take on more risk and write more mortgages to generate revenue, or still take this more conservative approach?
So part of the move towards less in-person lending is for a variety of reasons. One is just the industry has been moving into the digital space over the last few years, and now with the public health concerns, that sort of triggered that broader move. As far as taking on more risk, you know, as I said, you know, we have seen lending standards tighten, so where the industry is actually taking less risk. And with the current high volume that the industry is seeing because of the high demand, because of low rates, there are a lot of loans already in the pipeline. And I would also add one more thing that, you know, we are seeing independent mortgage companies now make up more than half the market. So it's not just banks. We're seeing both banks and these independents or non-depositories moving towards more digital presence.
Finally, banks are reporting quarterly earnings this week. Many analysts are expecting some big drops in profits. Wells Fargo has already warned it would cut its dividend for the first time since the recession of 2008. Is there a danger of another crisis similar to 2008 when taxpayers had to bail out many of the biggest banks?
I think this current crisis is a very different crisis than what we saw in 2008. We have seen a number of years now of very prudent, very cautious underwriting from the mortgage industry. We have seen home equity levels in many parts of the country for many homeowners, you know, at record highs or close to record highs. And the housing inventory is tight. We actually have a very low supply of homes for sale. So the uncertainty is just sort of across the board. So it's not just banks. I think, you know, we have many businesses now facing sort of an uncertain financial future, just sort of given the pandemic's impact to consumer spending and to business investment. So that being said, you know, our forecast is still for a healthy year for the mortgage industry, actually showing a slight increase in purchase originations and about a 50% increase in refinance volume over the year. So for the mortgage industry, at least, you know, we are still looking at a pretty good 2020.
Joel Kahn is Associate Vice President of Economic and Industry Forecasting at the Mortgage Bankers Association. Joel, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me, Kevin.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Protests across the city and the nation this summer are bringing new urgency to a message that is generations old: equality and justice. For years, Black women activists have delivered that message of race disparities. Keisha Blaine is an associate professor of history at the University of Pittsburgh. She recently wrote a piece about Black women activists for The Atlantic. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Keisha, in your article, you go back to the 1920s and write about Amy Ashwood Garvey. Who was she?
Well, Amy Ashwood Garvey was a Black nationalist activist. She was originally born in Jamaica in 1897. And for a short period of time, she lived in Harlem. And she is most known as the co-founder of the Universal Negro Improvement Association, which was perhaps the most influential Black nationalist organization of the 20th century.
Why did her message resonate in her time, a century ago?
Well, I think you have to certainly think about the context in which she was organizing. This is, of course, right after World War I, and it's also coinciding with a period that we refer to as the New Negro Movement. Most people know it as the Harlem Renaissance. And that's significant because it's a moment where people are also migrating. People are moving. Thousands of African Americans are leaving southern states, moving to northern states, to the west as well. And so this is a vibrant time, but it's also a difficult time because it's a time where Jim Crow policies, segregation laws are in effect. But it's also a period where we see a lot of militant activism.
You note that she and others spoke in public places, parks, sidewalks, community gatherings. Was that new at the time?
No, it wasn't. You know, what's really fascinating, if you look at the history, is that one of the earliest public speeches that we have documented is one that goes back to 1832. And this is Mariah Stewart, a Black woman abolitionist, women's rights activist, speaking in the city of Boston. And she gave this dynamic talk addressing feminist politics, also addressing civil rights. And at the time she gave this talk, millions of African Americans were enslaved, primarily in the U.S. South. And she gave this talk as a free Black woman living in the North. It was certainly a dangerous thing to do, but it represented, I think, one of the earliest articulations of Black women standing in a very public space, declaring their commitment to Black rights and Black freedom.
How were they received in a public space?
And so I think the way people received black women then is certainly in some ways similar to the way that the black women are received today, which is that black activists, you know, black people in the community certainly were open to the messages that these women were presenting, and they were supportive. But these women faced a lot of criticism. Many people shunned them. Many people did not appreciate what they had to say. You know, they really did place their lives on the line.
You also write about Mitty Maud Lena Gordon in Chicago in the 1930s. Did her message build upon that of Amy Ashwood Garvey's?
Yes, Mitty Maud Lena Gordon was actually, for a period of time, a member of the Universal Negro Improvement Association. And that was key to her ideas about race, certainly, about internationalism. However, Gordon did try to move in different directions. And so if you compare, for example, differences in the leadership structure or even religious beliefs, Gordon's organization embraced Islam as the official religion, which the Universal Negro Improvement Association did not do.
I think that many of our listeners will be more familiar with the activism of Angela Davis in the 60s and 70s, of course, a scholar, a member of the Communist Party USA, and a Black Panther Party member. She was a militant opponent of the Vietnam War. Do you trace a line from Black women activists earlier in the 20th century to Davis?
I do. And so the book that I wrote, Set the World on Fire, actually that last chapter looks at the civil rights movement and the Black Power era. What is important to note is that someone like Mitty Maud Lena Gordon did not necessarily have the same kinds of ideas as Angela Davis. So, for example, Angela Davis, we know as a communist, we know as someone who's very much anti-capitalist. That's not true for Mitty Maud Lena Gordon. Mitty Maud Lena Gordon actually identified as, you know, someone who embraced capitalism, and more specifically, she would argue that black capitalism was the way to go. But there are also similarities, too, because Gordon opposed World War II in particular, and she was very vocal about it, so much so that it led to her arrest because she was discouraging her supporters from even serving in the U.S. military.
Keisha, what connections do you see between these women and others from 50, 100 years ago and today's black women activists, including leaders of Black Lives Matter?
Well, I think what's important to note is that these women are all very outspoken and direct, and they shoulder similar kinds of challenges, right? So these women are facing sexism, also racism and classism, and so they're encountering various kinds of resistance, but they're also trying to find ways to assert their voices.
How do you think today's activists, today's leaders will be heard? Will they be heard? Are they being heard more so than their predecessors or not?
Well, I think they are being heard. And here is where we have to think about the role of social media. It allows individuals to have a very wide platform. It allows people to share their ideas and for others across the nation, but also across the globe, to engage those ideas. And so within the context of Black Lives Matter, of course, we know that the hashtag started right on social media, and the co-founders of the movement have been able to use social media effectively to organize activists and to make their demands. And so they are certainly, I think, far more recognized if you're drawing a comparison to earlier periods of U.S. history, but that would very much be tied to differences in how our societies have changed, and social media is certainly key to that story.
Keisha Blaine is an associate professor of history at the University of Pittsburgh. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. The lack of a clear federal response to the coronavirus pandemic has left local elected officials to come up with their own rules and guidelines, which at times can contradict each other. As businesses open back up, mixed messages have made what's permissible and safe feel more like a matter of interpretation. WHYY's Nina Feldman reports that forces individuals to make harder decisions more often than we're generally equipped to handle.
6 weeks into the lockdown, Tess Wilkinson Ryan's husband was walking their dog when he got the leash tangled around his ankle, fell back, and knocked his head.
And I said, sort of like, are you feeling okay? And then I said, like, ha ha, you know, quick, who's the president? And he said, deadpan, George Bush. And he wasn't joking.
Wilkinson Ryan spent the next few hours trying to figure out if her husband had a serious concussion and if it was safe to take him to the ER.
And I thought, this is outrageous. This is a decision that requires expertise, and the stakes are actually pretty high. And in that case, asking individuals to navigate it is actually not fair.
Wilkinson Ryan, who teaches psychology and law at UPenn, finally reached a doctor friend who helped her calculate the risk. She and her husband walked to the hospital, he was triaged into a non-COVID wing, and now he's fine. But had she not called her friend with expertise, Wilkinson Ryan would have had no way of knowing what to do.
But it struck me that we couldn't possibly be the only people in the situation.
When the pandemic first started, directions were clear. Stay home. But now that businesses are starting to open, everyone has their own idea of what feels safe to them. Pennsylvania's color-coded, phased reopening system doesn't make it any easier. When the governor said a county was ready to switch from yellow to green, it was natural to assume that green meant go. But in some cases, restrictions remained, and green signaled take it slow. That makes it hard to know what green actually means.
People are perceiving mixed messages from, okay, we're going to go ahead and start opening up as a state or as a city, but we really do want you to stay home most of the time.
That's Ellen Peters. She runs the Center for Science Communication Research at the University of Oregon.
And to a lot of people, I think that is telling you two, you know, sort of exactly opposite things. You know, the idea that the state is reopening sends a signal, well, you know, we're doing okay. Things are looking safe now. But then the message of, but you should really stay home, just sends exactly the opposite message.
Wilkinson Ryan's experience with her husband's concussion was an extreme example of one of the many new dilemmas people face all the time now. And she says it's the government's job to make those choices easier for people by giving concrete guidance for specific situations, not broad categories like yellow or green. Otherwise, people end up interpreting the same rules differently. And that's where the judging comes in.
There's a little bit of shaming of individuals who go and take advantage of these open places, but that's pretty confusing because if they're open, why aren't you supposed to go to them?
Wilkinson Ryan wants to know how many times a week to go to the grocery store. She wants 6-foot circles on the grass at the park. The new rules for the new normal everyone keeps talking about. And she says we should demand those things from public officials instead of pointing the finger at each other.
It's sort of like I'm asking everybody to like decide their own speed limit based on like, think about the make and model of your car. Think about who you're going to drive with. Think about the importance of your destination. Good luck.
Of course people would go different speeds. Who could blame them? Nina Feldman, Philadelphia.
And for today, that is The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. You can find more from this and past episodes of The Confluence online at wesa.fm/confluence and through your favorite podcast app. Thanks to our team, Helen Wigger, Tom Hurley, Joya Zenkovich, and Doug Shugerts. Until next time, I'm Kevin Gavin. Hope you have a good day of good news.